I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello guys, and welcome to this Caged In conversation where I sat down with Daniel Noah, a writer, producer, director and co-founder of the fantastic Spectrevision, along with Lisa Welland, Josh Waller and Elijah Wood. This is possibly one of my favorite conversations I've ever had on the podcast. So I know you're going to enjoy it. I very much enjoyed having this conversation. It gets off to like this really esoteric start, and we get into the things like the paranormal. And I feel like that really helped us to kind of like get into that heavy topic right up front, and then just kind of made the rest of the conversation really easy to have. I mean, Daniel ended up just chatting afterwards for a little bit as well, and there's certain things that he told me that unfortunately I cannot tell a living soul. Don't try and hit me up on social media to know what that is, because I don't want the Spectrevision hitmen after me for divulging some tales. But it was a great conversation. And one thing I really wanted to address up front is the elephant in the room on this episode, which is Richard Stanley. And I want to make it perfectly clear my views on Richard Stanley. I believe Richard Stanley to be, and I think rightfully, is a piece of shit. I want to quickly read out what Spectrevision had to say when the news of Stanley's abuses that he had caused to an ex-partner came out. They handled it perfectly by coming out straight away and really saying, this is who we are, we believe women. Something that a lot of studios don't tend to do. So it was a real breath of fresh air to hear this, or to read this statement, which is, Spectrevision will no longer work with Richard Stanley. We are proud of the talented cast and crew behind Colour Out of Space, yet we are horrified by the charges against its director. We will be donating future revenue from the film to charities devoted to stopping domestic violence. You can't really argue that. That is fucking hats off to them. If anyone from Spectrevision is listening, hats off to you guys. And I wanted to take a quick moment to kind of, because I have this soapbox and this platform, this week and any week, I would love, especially this week, I know I sometimes ask for you to join Patreon and stuff like that. I don't want any of that. You'll be able to look in the show notes, and I've listed a handful of domestic abuse charities that you can donate to, because I believe this is like, yeah, with this platform, it's sometimes good. Well, it's always good to share things that can help people. And if in any way, like we can help people, that's amazing, right? So yeah, so be sure to check all that out, and be sure to enjoy this conversation. I just wanted to get, obviously, all of that stuff out of the way. But yeah, that's why it's not addressed in this conversation, because it's, this podcast isn't about that. So enjoy my conversation with Daniel Noah. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by a writer, director, producer, clairvoyant, Daniel Noah of Spectrevision. So you may be aware of his name. Well, he's one of the people, when you see that, produced by the producers of Mandy. This is one of the guys they're talking about. Daniel Noah, how are you today?
Hi, good. Thank you. That was the first time I've heard clairvoyant included in my introduction. That's a funny sounding word.
I recently listened to a podcast show on Hollywood is Dead, and you refer to yourself is that a fair assessment of who you are? Would you align yourself as a clairvoyant, or is it kind of a muddled area for you?
You know, I'm so uncomfortable with the vocabulary around this stuff. I think it's, we use the best words available to us, but I don't know that I feel that they're sufficient. I was a very hardcore skeptic for my entire life until 2015, when I was a sort of a key party in an undeniable paranormal event that completely turned my head around. And then, strangely, inexplicably, from that event forward, it has been somewhat nonstop. There's been so many subsequent, anomalous experiences that I've been a part of that it's just completely changed my whole relationship to reality, and even really my relationship to the work that we do, which I used to think was just the stuff of fantasy. And I've now come to wonder if on some level I was unconsciously trying to address real phenomena that I didn't understand intellectually was real. the reason that I speak about it publicly is that when it first happened, I was very ashamed, and I felt very embarrassed and afraid of how my peers and colleagues and would react to me talking about this stuff, because until it happened to me, I was very judgmental of people who talked about these things. And when I was when we were publicizing Visitations, our podcast, the publicist reached out and said, would you be interested in, you have an invitation to be on Spooked. Have you ever had any paranormal experiences? And I was like, shit, I don't know if I want to do this, but I the reason that I did it was that I was so lost with what I was going through, and I had no idea where to turn for support or information. And one of the things in particular that was very confusing for me was that at any time I ever heard a good ghost story or, someone sharing a paranormal experience, it was always just the story of a one-off. Mm-hmm. And I was desperately searching for any examples of people like me for whom it was happening all the time, over and over again. And I was, overwhelmed by and afraid. And because I couldn't find any resources, what went through my head was, well, maybe then I need to become a resource. Mm-hmm. Because people don't seem to be comfortable talking about these things. So maybe one way that I can contribute to the furthering of this cause is by being the person that I can't find. So I went on Spooked, and that led to invitations from a lot of other paranormal podcasts. And I just decided I'm going to say yes to every invitation that I get, because if I can help others like me to realize that they're not alone, then maybe I've done some good. And it's led to actually me being plugged into a vast network of other experiencers, many of whom are closeted, so to speak. I mean, it's shocking how many high profile people in my industry are either interested in these subjects or, like me, are experiencers who are afraid to talk about it publicly. I mean, I wouldn't be right for me to name them, but like, it's people you know and love, so you know, it's really been rewarding, and so far as I've made some incredible friends, and now, you know, I've been tapped into incredible resources, and the study of the paranormal has become a central preoccupation of my life at this point. I'm constantly collecting out of print books, which I would argue are suppressed information. When you really approach this area with an open mind and a scientific mind, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that there is legitimacy to the paranormal phenomenon, and that the reason that I think the powers that be suppress this information is that it suggests that our scientific method is extremely limited, mm-hmm. which is a very unsettling concept to a species that likes to believe they're in control. And so, you know, this stuff gets really wild, but, you know, history is written by the winners, mm-hmm. and that extends to publishing.
Yeah.
And when you start to understand the burned books concept, mm-hmm. and if you go back even to the birth of, or not the birth of, but there's no better word for it. The war that happened, from the Catholic, on the part of the Catholic Church,
yeah.
in the 1300s, they literally burned anyone who didn't subscribe to their belief system. Mm-hmm. They scrubbed every other belief from the books. I mean, burning books, burning people. Mm-hmm. And although ironically, Catholicism today is one of is probably the only organized religion or institution that is somewhat open to paranormal. A phenomenon. I mean, like, they believe in demon possession and exorcism, and yeah. So by today's standards, they're quite progressive. But you know, you start to when you seek out these out of print texts, you start to understand that things that we now regard as quite silly, the stuff of fantasy, there may be some legitimacy to some of these sciences, like alchemy, and yeah. but how can we know? Mm-hmm. Because the evidence has been erased. And so I'm not saying that alchemy is legitimate, but I'm not saying that it isn't.
Yes.
and so I've been humbled because I've had things happen to me that I don't understand and I can't explain. And the more that I open myself to it and willfully look at it, mm-hmm. as they say, you know, if you stare into the abyss, eventually the abyss will stare back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the more I've sort of spiritually dedicated myself to engagement with these anomalous phenomena, the more they engage back. And it's a fascinating, fascinating process. At times I think I'm losing my mind. but I think that, you know, that in some ways is really the role of the artist in civilization is to be willing to engage with experiences that frankly can make you crazy. And then, you know, you walk out of the dark cave and you tell the tale. And so I do look at my advocacy for the legitimacy of paranormal research as an extension of my role as a storyteller. I think they're very aligned, very similar. And it's advocating for highly, highly subjective experiences that are difficult to talk about, difficult to quantify, to qualify. So whether those are, purely earthbound emotional experiences or inexplicable paranormal experiences, to me, they all sort of live in the same world. They're, you know, they're things that are hard to talk about. And that's the role of the artist, the shaman, you know, is to talk about those things. And so I try to.
It's fascinating for me that obviously this kind of openness to the paranormal and you kind of speaking about it came out of that promotional tour for Visitations. an episode that really stood out to me was the Flying Lotus one. And he's very open about the fact that he believes his house is haunted. Yeah. And there's something amazing you guys managed to capture on that episode. And all the episodes, you kind of get a feeling of the person with like, and on that one, it's raining and like, he does that amazing, like improvised, like just shows you guys a bit of like piano so work and stuff like that. And it's just like, I remember like feeling like, I don't like yourself. I used to be like, I've always been a skeptic, but kind of been in that kind of gray area of being like, I want to believe, do you know what I mean? Like very much like the ex. And then like even like listening to something like that, it's like I think there is something there. And I'm looking at the films you got, and I think it's a great jumping off point to talk about the paranormal, because it feels like especially two of the films that star Nick Cage have kind of ghosts like looming over them, whether it's Mandy, like with like kind of, I know that Panos has said that that film is an expression of his grief, like the kind of outpouring of grief of losing loved ones. So you very much like, I don't know, I think once I heard that in an interview, it really like opened my mind to watch that film again and kind of like put myself into it and that thing. And Color Out of Space as well. I know Nick has openly said that he was kind of channeling the spirit of his father on that one.
Yeah.
Backtrack with that. Like, were you privy to any of like this, like with Mandy especially? Were you privy to kind of like the subtext that Panos had in there, like from the start, or was it kind of later on that you picked up on it?
It was only later on. I think it, you know, when the film was released and everyone was looking at it, including us, you know, I think a lot of times when you make a work of art, you're operating on instinct, and it's only later that you go, oh, this was about my dad or what, you know, sometimes you're aware of it and sometimes you're not. I have no idea how aware of it Panos was at the time, but I know that he started to discuss the film having, well, both of his films, also Beyond the Black Rainbow, which I think he described as an inhale and Mandy as an exhale, were him processing the loss of his parents. And so whether or not he was aware of that at the time, I can't say. You'd have to ask him. But he brought it up a lot when we were looking back at the completed film, for sure. But on Color, Nick was talking about it on set. And, you know, he is a very professional, kind-hearted, very, you know, easy to deal with artist, contrary to what I think a lot of people would expect from him. He's actually a total pro. But he's on set. He said, I'm channeling my father. Be careful. And, you know, and he, you know, he, I hope he wouldn't mind my saying, I mean, there were times when he said, like, I feel like I'm losing my mind on this. And I mean, he went all in. Yeah. And that voice that he does that people were saying, oh, he's doing Trump. You know, that didn't occur to any of us. You know, he was doing his dad. That was his dad's very critical voice that I think he still hears in his head. So he really became his father, and I think it was hard for him. But again, you know, this is an extension of what I said earlier about the role of the artist is to walk into that dark cave and confront the demon and then live to tell the tale. And he did that on Color Out of Space.
So you and Elijah got to visit the set of Color Out of Space. How was that? Because obviously, like, there's I had the pleasure of speaking to Dan Martin, the visual effects artist on that film last October, and like, yeah, he had nothing but kind words to say about Nick and the kind of way he was. And I guess from what you're saying, like, it must have been like that weird thing that he is channeling his foot, and he's kind of like, how was Nick on set, and how was the set in general?
It was a beautiful and haunting experience. We were shooting at the top of a mountain in Sintra, Portugal, which is a very, very, a very special place. You know, I again, it's hard for me to talk about these things without constantly invoking paranormal stuff, but you know, but there is a long legacy of mountains being places on our planet that vibrate energies that are hard to understand. And when you were on that set, you could feel it. I mean, there was a very, very strange feeling there. You know, there's a shot right before the meteor hits of the full moon with a big ring around it.
Yeah.
That's not a VFX.
Wow.
That's not VFX. That happened. And we pointed the camera at it and put it in the movie. And there were things like that happening constantly on that set, just strange little events and experiences. It felt very disorienting, but it was a beautiful, very positive experience. Sintra is a strange place. Aleister Crowley spent time there, and it's traditionally been a place for people who are who have somehow been ejected from society. They will land in Sintra for some reason. Like Lord Byron was there licking his wounds for a long time. And like I said, and Crowley was there, and obviously Pessoa, the poet. So that, you know, this, it's, you can feel it kind of hanging over the place. And the house where we shot was had once been the home of a very wealthy man, and I'm forgetting his name, but he lost everything, and the house had just been, you know, sort of standing there in disrepair. At one point, we discovered that if you walked, there was thick woods around the property surrounding the house, and at one point, someone discovered that if you wandered back through the woods, there was a tiny pagan church.
Wow.
And there were, you could see where some sort of, you know, like pagan symbols had been once, you could see their outlines of their silhouettes on the wall, like someone had pulled them down. And my girlfriend and I went back in there and remember just felt, you could feel something very weird. Like what, who built this? Why, what happened? And then we discovered that there are these underground tunnels.
Wow.
On the property that were so narrow that no one had the courage to, you could have probably crawled through. I don't know what you call that in the army, where you get on your, you're crawling on your elbows.
Yeah.
I forget what that's called, but I think you could have made it through if you did that. And I actually went in at one point and I got about 25 feet and I was like, get me out of here. I can't, this is terrifying. So none of us know where those tunnels go, but they're down there.
If like hearing that kind of thing, like makes that film, ever so more special and stuff like that. And I guess like one of the things I wanted to ask you is obviously Spectrevision has this almost looking for people who have these singular visions, like the films you've produced, whether it's A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night or I guess one that is kind of like the most divisive film you've ever put out is The Greasy Strangler. Yeah. What is it you guys kind of look for when you're looking for a script or looking for someone to work with?
I think first and foremost, we're director driven, we're filmmaker driven. Mm-hmm. Something that we often say is people, not projects.
Yes.
When we first met with Panos, we had seen Beyond the Black Rainbow. And I remember saying to his manager, Luke Rivett, you know, and this was before we even met Panos. I said, I think Panos might be one of the most important filmmakers alive, you know, just based on that film. And of course, he was like, that's music to my ears. Great. And we and when we met with him, Elijah and myself, we the first thing we said was, we don't even care what it is. We want to produce your next movie. We don't even need you to pitch it. It's just because it's you, we're in. And amazing. And then some number of months later, he gave us the script for Mandy. And, you know, we were already in before we even read it, because, of course, anything this filmmaker produces is going to be incredible. So, and in fact, the script for Mandy, Elijah doesn't always agree with me on this, but as you might be able to imagine, in my opinion, the script was sort of dull. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and the reason is, as Panos likes to say, and I love this phrase he uses, the tyranny of narrative. He is sort of like he's an enemy of plot. And when you really look at what happens in Mandy, it's like nothing.
Yeah.
You know, there's like 45 minutes of a couple hanging out watching TV, and then she's killed, and then he just kills all the people that killed her. That's the whole pitch. So on paper, it was hard to convince people that this was going to be an important film. And what we finally ended up doing was, instead of sending the script out, we started sending out links to Beyond the Black Rainbow and saying, look at, don't like, stop looking at the script. Look at this person's mind to understand what this film will be. And it was only then that it came together. So this is a very long-winded way of saying we love singular artists, and I think we look at our job as being, you know, how can we support the mining of their ideas as best as possible, protect them, and challenge them and push them to be the best versions of themselves that they can possibly be.
So with with Mandy, it's a very fascinating film in the fact that, like, kind of the storm around it, like the kind of like a lot of films take years to become cult films. And that film felt like, even before it came out, it kind of had this cult-like status. And like, what was it like to be in like the somewhat middle of that like whirlwind of everything that was going on? Like, kind of, it was, almost like pitched as like, this is the next Midnight movie.
I mean, I know when I think what you have to understand is that I'll put it this way. The night that it premiered at Sundance, it wasn't that yet.
Yes.
It was just, it was in a Sundance program, and that was it. There was no trailer. I walked in convinced that 25% of the people would be their favorite movie. 25% of the people would think it was a little weird, and 50% would hate it. and when it was actually like 100% loved it, I was very, very shocked. I thought the same thing would happen with Greasy Strangler, which I know is more divisive, but I was expecting walkouts, and one of the things I've learned is that it's when you're working on a film or any kind of a work of art, it's very hard to trust your own feelings about it. I've also, worked on stuff where I've thought this is going to change the world, and then it doesn't. And so I've just sort of learned to wait and see, but once it, I think that when you work on something that is successful, it's easy to sleepwalk through it a little bit and not stop to recognize that you're in the middle of a very privileged moment.
Yeah.
And so I think when I look back at the Mandy experience, it was great fun, but if I could do it over again, I wish I could be a little more present, I think, and really stop and breathe and take in what was happening. I often joke like Mandy will probably be on my gravestone. Like, it's the everything we do now is from the producers of Mandy. And I hope we'll make it, now it's saying from the producers of Mandy and Colorado Space, but I hope we'll achieve that height again, but you can't control these things. You do your best, you hope for the best, and then whatever happens, happens.
So when did you become aware of Jim Hoskin as well? Like, speaking of the Greasy Strangler, because Jim to me is a fascinating guy, and the stuff he's done since. And like, I kind of fell down a wormhole the other day of watching his old like shorts or like TV commercials. He did some iconic like TV commercials here in the UK and stuff like that. So like, how did he drop onto your radar?
That started with Tim League, actually, from Alamo Drafthouse, and he and Elijah are very close friends, and I forget, I think he and Ant Timpson approached us, and we're like, you got to see this thing, you got to read the script and look at this guy's work. We're putting in money, we need one more partner. And I remember Elijah did something that we typically don't do here, is he called and he said, we're making this, no one else has a vote. So we came in as the third investor/producer, and we ended up then also doing production services on the film, and so we were sort of the front line along with Ant. It was a teeny little low budget. I don't know if the budget's out there in the world or not, but it was, I'll just say, sub 1 million, very sub 1 million. And, our experience of it was hanging out in a weird rundown house on the East Side and, a lot of weird, sweaty nudity. And, it's like, you never know when you're working on something, you don't know what the outcome's going to be. And you just try and have a good time. But Jim's actually a really, like a lot of filmmakers who make weird cinema, he's very normal.
Yeah,
and my theory about that is that it's because they get the weird out. So yeah. And in that way, art is an exorcism. Mm-hmm. You're taking the strangest, most unique, and sometimes painful parts of yourself, and you're extracting them and putting them on a screen or in a novel or in a painting. And by doing so, you sort of make yourself healthier. You get it out. Imagine if Jim didn't have that outlet, he could be the Greasy Strangler. Right?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
So he's a very sweet, normal, you would never guess that he made such strange stuff by just sitting and talking with him.
So, kind of to backtrack, where did Spectrevision come from, and what did you guys set out to do when it first kind of the germ came to you?
Well, we met Elijah and Josh Waller and I. Well, Josh Waller and I are old friends, and we met on a project that never got made. I had been working as a screenwriter. This is a phenomenon that I never knew it existed until it happened to me, which was a very well-paid, unproduced Hollywood screenwriter. I'd been doing that for about 10 years. I'd only had one movie get made. And so I had written a film that Elijah was attached to star in. Taika Waititi was attached to direct. And this was back in 2010. And that movie didn't get made. And we were so frustrated with that experience that Taika said, I'm going to go home and make a little low budget movie with my friends. It's going to be a mock doc about vampires. Mm-hmm. And he went home and made What We Do in the Shadows. And then Elijah came to us and said, let's start our own company. And then we can do two things. One, we can be a home for artists that want to make strange, wonderful, weird, unique genre movies, because at that time the genre landscape was pretty dominated by exploitation. The Eli Roth films were very popular, and Saw, and no disrespect of those movies, I think they're great, but there was sort of an emphasis on sadism in genre, and whereas Elijah and I were looking at movies like Let the Right One In and The Orphanage, and then looking back in time, Don't Look Now and Rosemary's Baby and the films of Val Lewton from the 1940s and the Universal Monster movies, and going like, where are these films in English, in America? Who's making these movies? And the answer was no one. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to create a home for filmmakers that wanted to sort of return to the elevation of genre. But simultaneously, we had collectively so many disappointing experiences with producers who were were ultimately somewhat transactional. Mm-hmm. Can, you know, your film is a widget for them to sell and nothing more. And you know, as two guys who are very passionate about the art form, you know, we had had some wonderful experiences with producers whom we felt kinship with, but they were hard to find. So the other experiment was, well, what, I guess sort of like I said earlier about when I couldn't find anyone to advocate for paranormal experiencers, I think, you know, Elijah and Josh and I were like, well, what, let's just become the producers that we have trouble finding.
Yeah.
And so, you know, most companies, the way they start are with economic considerations, and then everything is an outgrowth. So it starts with you get an equity partner, you open an office, and now right out of the gate, every decision that you make is based on meeting your obligations to your investor. And as such, you can't take chances. You have to be as conservative as possible. We decided, let's flip it. Let's have our first step be engagement with material. So we did not go out and find an equity partner. We did not rent an office. We used to joke that we were the Lincoln Lawyer production companies because we were literally driving around taking meetings in coffee shops, which, you know, I think in some ways we were afforded that luxury by having Elijah as a partner. It legitimized us because he was so established. But the other thing that we had going for us was sincerity. You know, we were very sincere. And so we would sit down, we just called people we knew. Like Lee Wannell was someone that we just knew and who wrote Cooties for us. And we would sit down and say, do you have a passion project in the genre space that no one will help you with because it's too hard or it's too weird? And that's a magic question with an artist. So every time they would kind of be like, is this a trick question? Of course I do. And then they would pitch us these gorgeous projects. And those were exactly the types of films that we wanted to build our brand around. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is a great example. Yeah. But, you know, it was very synchronistic. Two different people approached us separately. One, Mojan Marnot, was a friend of mine. She was like, I'm attached to this Iranian vampire film that sounds like exactly what you guys are saying you want to do. And then Sherry Devani, who was the AD on that film, approached Elijah, was a friend of his, and said the same thing. And we were like, it was a strange, like, we both got hit up about this movie. And when we sat down with Anna Lily, it was just immediately evident that she, like Panos, was just a visionary filmmaker. And so we got on board that, you know, right away. And then Cooties was an idea that Josh had that Lee was so excited about because he had been desperate to move into comedy and no one would let him do that. They just wanted more Saws and Insidiouses. And then, so we made those two movies and they both got into Sundance the same year. And so we had sort of this, you know, spectacular coming out, so to speak. And then we were off and running.
What would you say is the like Spectrevision ethos? If you have one, do you guys kind of have this like thing of like, this is what the company is like, do you know what I mean? Or is it kind of?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think it's, I can answer that in two ways. One is the content and one is the context, I guess. So you know, content wise, we're interested in singular visions. And I think, you know, like I said earlier, in some ways, I think you only understand your work in retrospect.
Yes.
But when I look back at our catalog, what I see is not only unique voices, but a sort of a strange story being told about windows in other worlds. And in fact, when we named the company, it took us 6 months to land on the name. We were very picky about it. And what we said was, and I think this gets, well, this is still content, I suppose. What we said was, you know, we want, in the name, we want to represent the fusion of two things. Something ineffable, ethereal, untouchable, undefinable, and then something mechanical, like a window into another universe. Yeah. And so that's literally the when you break down spectre vision is literally looking into another world. And so I think that's what all of our films have in common, is that whether it's Greasy Strangler, which is not a paranormal story, but it's certainly an alternate universe, or something like Color Out of Space, where there's an actual intrusion of an alien that's so alien that we can't even perceive it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the finale of that film is about something that's happening that exists outside the spectrum of the five senses. So what actually happens at the end of Color Out of Space? Human beings can't know.
Yeah.
If you saw the finale of that film from the perspective of the alien that came in on the meteorite, it would be a completely different story. I can't tell you what that is. I don't know. I'm only a human, right? And then in terms of the ethos of the, or I guess, you know, the context is, I you know, it sounds, I don't know, maybe pretentious, but I think we just try to be good people as much as we can. And you know, sometimes we stumble, but we try to honor our commitments and be genuinely loving and supportive to the people that we work with and who work for us. Because, you know, this, look, in the 10 years since we started this business, there's been a real reckoning in Hollywood of people being held accountable for bad behavior. And it's great. You know, I'd like to think it was something that was on our minds before people were being held accountable for it. And, you know, we've always worked very hard to be good as much as we can. And our company's grown. I mean, it started out with the three of us. Josh has subsequently left to focus on his directing career, which, you know, power to him. He directed three movies before we started Spectre Vision. And then, you know, Spectre Vision sort of took over his life. And so he's sort of, I think, reclaiming his original intention. You know, we've grown significantly and we try and treat our company like a family and you know, our employees like a family. And I think, you know, they seem to stick around. So I think they feel that. I hope they feel that way too. I want them to.
Well, that definitely comes across in the films that you make, because it kind of feels like that thing of, like you said, it comes across that Spectre Vision is about like the people, the directors before, and it's what they want to say and what they want to show people, as opposed to being like, here's just another, do you know what I mean? Like, here's another X film, or do you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to start bad mouthing like companies, but like, it's kind of what I like about Spectre. Every time I kind of see that logo pop up on a film, it's like, well, I don't know what I'm going to get. Cause like, not one, two movies are the same, but like, I think the one similarity that they do all share is that they are unique unto themselves. And you mentioned about Josh going off to direct. Obviously, you've directed a film.
And yeah.
In email, we kind of chatted about the fact that it's impossible to find in the UK. Is there any yearning inside of you to direct again, or are you kind of like,
no,
happy to be on the other side of it, the producing?
No, I'm very happy where I am. I you know, Max Rose was it was a complicated experience for me. It was based on the story of my grandfather, who was a beloved figure in my life and my childhood. And when my grandmother passed away, I was very up close and personal with his grieving process. And what I watched him go through for the little window of time that he was still alive after he lost her was a phenomenon that I felt like I'm going to keep repeating these same ideas, but I felt like I didn't know where to turn to look for any context about, you know, what it's like to lose your soulmate and have people all over you saying, in some ways, denying your pain. You'll find new reasons to live. And when you've lost the person who was your reason to live, that's a funny thing to hear, you know? And so while my grandfather did not commit suicide, I think one does in a way in that position by sort of losing the will to live. And what confused me as someone who cared deeply for him was while he was telling me in private, I don't want to live on without her. I'm in my 80s. Mm-hmm. This idea that I'm going to have a new chapter of my life is ridiculous, and I don't want to. And then everyone around him sort of sticking to a script of no, everything's going to be great. You get, you know, and I was like, I know I'm not supposed to say this, but I'm with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, who are we to tell him how to feel? He's the one who's experiencing this. He's our elder. And so I decided to write a script about it. And so because it was such a personal movie to me, I felt like no one else could make that movie but me. And then when we were lucky enough to get Jerry Lewis to play the part, that ended up being an incredibly seismically important relationship in my life. I mean, we were very close for the last 10 years of his life. And he was an incredible mentor to me and became kind of a father figure in a lot of ways. And it's funny, there was a point in that where I realized, I'm doing it to myself again. I was knocked out by losing my grandfather. So I've found a replacement for him who will also die soon. And then, and that's exactly what happened. But anyway, so, you know, Max Rose it was a complicated experience. The reception of the film was very mixed, and I myself have a complicated relationship to it. But what I realized mostly from making that film, I think that, you know, we willed it into existence despite great opposition. And what I realized coming off of it is that I don't enjoy directing. Mm-hmm. I thought that was what I wanted, but when I got it, I realized that it didn't feel right to me. It didn't feel comfortable. And I'm much more at ease supporting filmmakers.
Yes.
I think that had I not gone through the process of writing and directing a film, I don't know that I would be as good at my job as I am now, because I've been there. I know what you go through. I know what the experience is in every way, technically, emotionally, spiritually. But I will never direct another movie. I don't have any desire to. No one's asking. And I'm very, very happy. I'm very, very content where I'm at making films with SpectraVision.
Do you feel that, like, producing movies, you can kind of like, you can enjoy them to some extent as well? Or is it kind of like,
oh yeah,
you're like a cog in there as well, and you kind of like, I don't know, you have a stake at play whilst watching them, or you're like, no, I like this vision that's being shown to me?
You know, look, to me, I studied screenwriting at NYU, and for me, story is the heart, the brain, the backbone of all aspects of filmmaking. Yeah. And so you can't perform any duty on a film without an understanding of story, hopefully a mastery of story. It doesn't matter what your job is. If you are a set deck, you have to understand the story that you're telling. And so to me, whether I'm writing, producing, or directing, it's about constantly trying to get better at mastery of story. And so when, I directed one movie, I was a professional screenwriter for about a decade. And when people ask me, do you miss writing? First of all, I still write. And I've written, I've done a lot of writing that I'm not credited on. And I have scripts that I've written that are going into production soon that I'll be able to talk about when they're announced. but my answer is, I'm still writing.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting down and typing, but I work so closely with every writer and every filmmaker. And I think that, when at first I was a little unsure of how writers would feel about another writer as their boss, frankly, coming in and having opinions. And I've thought, oh, geez, are people going to feel proprietary? But what I've discovered is that as I felt when I was in that position, when I was a writer, when you have a producer who actually understands writing, it's just incredible
wave
of relief and excitement. And that was how I felt when I was the writer who would occasionally get a producer who actually understood how the process worked. And I found, I've had one after another wonderfully satisfying, delicious collaborations with writers. And so in some ways I feel like as a producer, because I'm not actually writing anything, I'm able to work on exponentially more stories than I could if I were writing them myself and dip in and out and I cycle through them. But it's still storytelling.
So what does like a producer tend to normally do? And how do you think you guys do something different to other like producers and kind of like, yeah, do you treat your, your directors differently to how I've, and not to badmouth like other studios or anything.
I think, you know, one of the most common questions that people ask is, what does a producer do?
And there's
a lot of answers to that question. There's raising money. There's managing a set. There's managing a budget. And then there's managing creative. So that's the one that I do. I manage creative, and that's what Elijah does as well. Lisa Whalen, who's our third partner, is also creative, but she is also fills in, Elijah's in my blanks in terms of running a business and the operational aspects that we're not so good at. I think we're very, very hands-on. I think we're, in some ways, when you make a film with SpectraVision, you are partnering with SpectraVision. We have a strong voice. We're very opinionated. We're not shy about our opinions. But what we're very, very careful to do is to always make sure that every opinion that we have and every move that we make is in service of the director's vision. It's not our vision.
Yes.
It's the director's vision. And that's something that I've always enjoyed. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so happy to not be a director anymore, but to be working with directors, is that I love getting inside someone else's head, getting inside their intention and helping them. I find that incredibly delicious and rewarding, much more so than shepherding my own vision.
So
being a wingman for someone else is what I love to do. It's what Elijah and Lisa love to do. And I often hear that we're far more involved than most producers are. But I think if a filmmaker doesn't want that, then they shouldn't work with us. And many don't, for that reason. I mean, we've had filmmakers that we've wanted to work with who have declined. And I think in some ways it's because they didn't need the kind of active creative partnership that we bring, and they were right to decline. And so things have a tendency to work out.
So do you guys have like this kind of whiteboard that has a list of directors that you're like, we'd like to go after? Or is it like the people who you haven't heard of that you're most excited about?
It's both. I mean, I think it would be uncouth of me to name names, but we have a hit list of, I don't know if any of them are listening. You know who you are. I mean, there's a couple of people that we've been trying to, coax back to the scene like we did, like we've done in the past with some other filmmakers. And that's a long game, takes years. There's one person in particular who I hope to be able to say this person's name sooner or later, who is one of the finest filmmakers alive, that we're trying to convince to make a movie. And we're very lucky that we get access to these people. We have their ear and we take advantage of it. So I think we're nerd fans at heart, and we try and approach our work through that lens of like, what's the announcement in Variety that would make us lose our minds? It's like, let's create that announcement, But at the same time, we love being blown away by someone new. I just saw this film called Come True by Anthony Scott Burns that you know, it blew me away. And he and I have been talking, and you know, we're looking for a project to do together. You know, we're, I think, you know, we're, because we've taken chances on new voices, I think oftentimes we don't have to necessarily work for it. People just call us and go, have you seen this kid's film? And we go, no, you know, you're going to love it. And then we watch it and we do. So, you know, whether it's coaxing someone out of retirement or enabling someone that no one's heard of, you know, if we believe in the voice, we're all in.
In that thing of coaxing people, are you going to somehow coax Nick Cage back to Spectrevision to kind of finish off this kind of Spectrevision trilogy that he's kind of...
He's a friend of the family. We have mutually expressed a desire to continue working together. It's just, you know, when the right project comes along. We almost did something with him a couple years ago, right before the pandemic, but the schedule ended up not working out. I'd love to make more than one more movie with Nick. I'm not even going to play it cool. I am the, perhaps other than you, the biggest Nicolas Cage fan in the world. I was beside myself that we were making a movie with him on Mandy. I couldn't believe it. I think he is one of the finest, most vital artists of any medium ever. Has been until recently, I think, widely misunderstood. I'd like to think we've been a little bit of a part of people understanding him correctly. He is, insofar as an actor's body is their instrument, he has taken that to the nth degree, and he is an artist who lives in extremes.
Yeah,
he is as good or as bad as his director. And I think that's what people don't understand.
That's a drum I've been beating for a long time. It's like covering all of the Nick Cage films. Like, there's so many I watch and I go, like, this is a case of a director not knowing what to do with Nick Cage.
That's exactly right.
And it's that thing of, like, from speaking to directors he's worked with, it's like, he is the utmost professional guy. He will turn up day one. He will know the script back to front. He will kind of Brian Taylor, who's worked with him a couple of times, was like, he will come in, he will be like, I know the script to Mum and Dad back to front. Like, I will do whatever needs to be done. And I think Julian Hillard mentioned on Twitter recently that, like, Nick Cage taught him how to, like, improvise. Like, do you know what I mean? He's kind of like, he's got this...
Oh, Julian. Like,
From Color. It's like...
Well, he comes in not only knowing the script backwards and forwards, but knowing the like, having done script analysis six ways from Sunday, you know, he comes in with such a profound take on the material. And, you know, and he... I think that's why those who have had successful relationships with him are always emphasizing that he's a pro, because you can look at his wilder performances and you would make the assumption that he would be an unwieldy presence on set. He is, if you let him, but you tell him no, and he says, okay. You know, he had a thing on Color where, you know, some people don't pick up on this, but every member of the family has a different sensory relationship to the experience. So his is smell. Mm-hmm. He's constantly talking about bad smells. He wanted to have a closed pin on his nose the entire movie. And he'd be talking like this. And we were like, yeah, no. And he's like, okay, he's dropped it. But you know, I think when you, this is a testament to him as a professional. He's completely deferential to the filmmakers. You know, he knows his job is to take direction. So he's a little bit like a garden hose that's spraying water wildly. And if you know how to grab it, and control it, you can water your garden brilliantly. But if you're scared to touch it because you think it's going to whack you in the face, it's going to fly all over the place, right? And so, you know, I think when I see a quote unquote bad Nick Cage performance, what I see is it's not a bad performance. It's that they didn't know how to craft it. Mm-hmm. They didn't. And Panos would talk about Nick through the lens of, he would say that his job was to be Nick's equalizer, as a piece of a stereo component. And they crafted an arc in which, you know, he started as like a very subdued Nick Cage. And then little by little, he became more unhinged. And that was grafted. That performance was grafted together collaboratively. And Panos would talk about having his fingers on the levels of like, you know, knowing exactly when to go, okay, you know, the bass needs to kick in here. And the result is one of Nick's best performances. And I think we did the same thing on Color, you know, where it was, you know, this journey from this sort of button down family man to this complete maniac, you know, it was very carefully crafted. To me, he's quite simply one of the best actors we've ever had. I think, you know, it's really exciting to see this renaissance, you know, that he's having now, and people suddenly, instead of, you know, joking about Cage rage, they're now worshiping at the altar of one of our finest artists. And it's amazing to watch. I love it.
Well, what's interesting about the two films that he's worked on with you guys is that they both have what other people would put in like a sizzle reel of like Nick Cage loses his shit.
right.
Is that even that kind of freak out he does in the middle of Mandy and that moment in Color when he does the, like, he freaks out in the car. I call them they're earned freakouts.
Yes.
Within the story, they totally make sense. It's like him in that bathroom.
Yeah.
Totally makes sense to the plot of that movie. It's like he has just witnessed the death of the woman he loves more than anything, his savior. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, of course, like, that is a humanistic reaction to that. And it's
absolutely, it's
testament to Panos for kind of like bottling that energy in that moment. And like, it's that kind of like thing.
I definitely think
that, like, Cage, when I came to this podcast, it was around the time that it was kind of like hyped, memeable Cage. Do you know what I mean? I think there is a YouTube video called Nick Cage Loses His Shit. And even in that, and it's like, there's a link back to like one of my personal favorite Nick Cage films is Vampire's Kiss. He kind of recycles that voice from that in Color. Yeah. And I know that he said in interviews that that was inspired by his dad as well. Cause he was like, his dad was like a professor or like a kind of, So
he's
like
an academic, very critical.
Yeah, these academics kind of have this transatlantic accent that makes them sound a bit more like they know what they're going, they're borrowing a bit of Britishness to it and stuff like that, that makes them seem a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the bathroom scene in Mandy is one of my favorites because it's so emotionally raw that, you know, the few times that I saw that film in the theater, I remember half the audience is laughing and half is crying. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing to me. Mm-hmm. And I always felt that the half who are laughing because they're scared to cry. It's, you know, that is not funny, that scene. it's funny if you're avoiding what it's about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I watched, I remember very clearly the LA premiere of that film was at the Egyptian Theater. And I was literally that morning had returned from Big Sur, where my girlfriend and I had gotten engaged. So it was like vibrating with a feeling. And then when that scene hit, and it's the scene of a man who's lost the love of his life, I was just, I mean, I worked on the movie, you know, and yet I was just wrecked and overcome with feeling. And then I'm listening to people laugh and I'm going, wow, this is what movies can do. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's that thing, like I mentioned to you earlier, like, it wasn't on, like, the second watch of Mandy that, like, I kind of was like, I need to give myself over to this film a bit more. And it's that thing, like, I've never gone through, like, a loved one, the grief of a loved one, but, like, I kind of, like, brought that element of just, like, losing, like, that kind of love of your life, whether it's, like, a separation. And it's like, even just bringing that to that film, just really like, so you see it in a whole different prism of it. And it's just like, and I guess it's that thing, because the criticism I see of it a lot of the time is I think people expect it to be this kind of, I don't know, like 80 minute, like B movie. And it's not that. And
no.
And I think that, yeah, the vision that Panos gives us with this kind of quite slow and like, yeah, it's the thing on repeat watch, you kind of get that feeling that like all of the latter half, all of the vengeance and destruction that Red goes on is earned by this kind of first 45 minutes of him and Mandy, like just expressing their love.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful picture. As we start to wind things down, I guess we need to talk about some of the future projects. And first of all, a project that's kind of been floating around in the ether for a while is The Man with Kaleidoscope Eyes.
Yeah.
Is there any like news?
We're trying.
Will see the light of day?
We're trying. Yeah. Man with Kaleidoscope Eyes is a film that Joe Dante will direct, that is a comedic account of the events of 1967, during which Roger Corman was preparing to direct the movie The Trip, which was about Peter Fonda dropping acid. And what happened in life was that Peter and a young unknown actor named Jack Nicholson approached this very buttoned down Roger Corman and said, hey man, you can't make a movie about acid if you haven't dropped acid. And Corman, who was very logical, said, that's a good point. So he went up to Big Sur with this little caravan of bohemians and he dropped acid and it changed his life. It was after that he started his own company. He married his wife, Julie, whom he had just met and had been sort of a serial bachelor until that time. He had an incredibly positive therapeutic experience. So it's a script that's been around, 20 years or something. Colin Firth was going to do it at one time. And there's like this long history of actors that were attached to it. So we've been trying to put this movie together for years It's frustrating. This is my great frustration with the world of film finance, is that it's built entirely around the value of the actors who are attached. It's just sometimes you just want someone who can write a check for $3 million to just go, you know what? I get this. It's got an audience. Yeah. Just go, guys, just go. And because it's the catch-22 of it is that you can't, it's very hard to get the actors who can support a budget until you have money to offer them. And so we've been trying, and we have actually I can't say who they are, but we've actually cast most of the parts. We just haven't cast Corman. And so we're working on it. It's never far from our thoughts. we had this incredible staged reading of the screenplay in LA, and Bill Hader read Corman and it was amazing. Unfortunately his schedule with Barry and he can only make like one feature film a year. It's not possible for him to do a low budget movie, in that little window. We're trying.
Perfect. Well, let's talk about a project that is imminent for release and obviously getting its premiere at Tribeca, which is No Man of God. And I guess the whole Ted Bundy thing has kind of like been done to death. And I know I'm excited at the fact that you guys, with your kind of singular vision of things, must have seen something in this script. Like, what can you tell us about No Man of God?
Well, No Man of God is, when we first heard the pitch, like anyone, any reasonable person, we were like, nah, there's way too much Ted Bundy stuff. We don't want to do this. We don't want to contribute to the deification of this man. And then we read it. And what we saw in it was an opportunity to make a film that's not about Ted Bundy. It is about the audience for popular culture's desire to deify serial killers. Mm-hmm. And so the intention of the film is to turn the lens, so to speak, back onto the viewer and say, why do you keep showing up for this story? Mm-hmm. Look at who this is and look at what he's done. You know, it's one thing to have a Hannibal Lecter character who, you know, is sort of exists in a comic book world. But even that, mm-hmm. when you think about who you're rooting for and what he's done, and Amber Seeley, who we hired to direct the film, who is just a huge-hearted, brilliant, beautiful humanist, did something with the movie that is really incredible. There's only one female character in the film, Bundy's lawyer. But she made the film with a feeling of it being viewed through the eyes of the victims. Mm-hmm. Though they're not represented in the film, that was very deliberate, that we didn't name them, we didn't put any images of them. Amber, every time she made a choice with the camera, with the music, with the editing, it was always about the ghosts of the women whose lives that he took. So it's really the story of accountability, and not only accountability for Bundy, you know, who has been treated as a rock star, you know, and even the Zac Efron movie, you know, if you cast Zac Efron, of course, he's going to be a sex symbol, right? Yeah. And it's no disrespect. Luke Kirby's a very handsome guy, but just, you know, Luke came in and he said, I want to play this guy like a dirty ashtray. He lost a ton of weight. He got, you know, And so we wanted to kind of pull the curtain back on the wizard a little bit and say, this isn't a movie about a serial killer. It's a movie about movies about serial killers. And it hopefully asks the question, why do you like this? And what harm are you doing by continuing to treat these people as rock stars and celebrities? I hope that's what we accomplished with it. I think we did. We'll see how people feel about it.
Well, I'm sure I speak for a lot of people when I say I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
I'm sure plenty of other people like just seeing, like, I think there's two like stills from it, and I'm just like, yes, please, like, give me. So as I always ask people on this podcast, especially when it's revolved around Nick Cage, is what is your personal favorite Nick Cage movie?
Oh, man. Wow.
And I know you've got a couple of horses in the race. They don't count.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to say Leaving Las Vegas. He's so heartbreaking in that film. And it's like everything that he's great at. Mm-hmm. You know, it's heightened, but it's heightened and it exists in a real world. You know, he just absolutely breaks my heart in that movie. He's so tender and so vulnerable and so brave. I'd have to go with Leaving Las Vegas.
Perfect. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for coming and joining me for this podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Same. I really enjoyed the conversation. I'm so glad that you invited me.
And there we have it, guys. That was my conversation with Daniel Noah. And I'm sure you will agree that it's one of the best ones, right? Like, no offense to any of my previous guests or interviewees. There's something about that one that just really, really stood out to me. And I had a lot of fun chatting to Daniel, and I really, really do hope that you enjoyed listening to it. And I'd love to know what you guys thought, like, please, like, you don't have to do it even like publicly on social media. Drop me a message. Like, I'm on all of them. I'm always in my DMs. Do you know what I mean? You can always find me in the DMs. Or drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. One thing I really want to do for this episode as well is say a massive thank you to two people. One of them is Daryl Edge of the Cage Rage podcast, who helped me set up this interview in a weird way. I noticed that Daniel Noah was following him on Twitter and said, hey man, could you slip into Daniel Noah's DMs and get him to follow me, or like, yeah, give him my email or get his email for me so I can get an interview, because when I started this podcast, or like when I came back this podcast, should I say, I wrote a list of people I'd love to speak to, and the top of that list were three names, and they were Elijah Wood, Daniel Noah, and Panos Cosmatos. So that's one of the three down. Let's pester the other two. Not too much, but let's try and pester the other two to see if they can come on the podcast at some point. And the other person I would really like to thank is Hannah Wood from Spectrevision, who really, through like emailing that, really helped to kind of make this a really smooth episode. Like, do you know what I mean? It made it really smooth for like me and Daniel to get connected and sorting out the dates and stuff like that. So yeah, Hannah, if you're listening, thank you very much. So as always, guys, I've been Petros Patsilivas. I've been caged in. I'll catch you next time.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.